Welcome to Honey from the Rock, a podcast devoted to Bible exposition. My father, Jack Christensen, preached expositionally for over 50 years, first as a missionary to Pakistan and later as a pastor in New England. His legacy lives on in me. He often began his sermons with a little expression, and now a little honey from the rock, taken from Psalm 81, verse 16. The psalmist wrote, "I would feed you with the finest of the wheat, and with honey from the rock I would satisfy you." Today, more than ever, we need to feed our souls on the words of God in the Bible. The crying need of the church is for God-centered, word-explaining messages. So now, my friends, a little honey from the rock. Native Americans in the Great Plains often set fire to the grasslands. These intentional burns had a purpose. Sometimes, the fire was intended to force the buffalo in a specific direction. They also used fire to drive the grasshoppers to a particular location where they could be collected for food. However, most often, the Native Americans used fire to purify the grasslands. They knew that the grass that grew back would have tall, straight stalks that they could use for basket making. The grasslands would be healthier and stronger because of the burn. Europeans moving west did not understand the value of purifying fires. They feared them. They were terrified by them. The Europeans passed laws to outlaw what they called Indian burning. The result was that the grasslands grew into dangerous fuel for fires, and many massive and destructive fires resulted from the ban on Indian burning. Prairie fires in the Midwest purge the prairie and bring new life to the fields. Stephen Packard, science director for the Nature Conservancy of Illinois, writes, "A prairie burning is something like a great thunderstorm. You experience the raw power of nature. After you've burned it off, nothing is left. It's so pure. Every leaf that emerges is new and shiny and wet. Every flower petal is perfect. It reminds you of being young. The fire produces regeneration, produces new life. The same is true for our souls. The fires of God's discipline regenerate our souls. God seeks our holiness more than he seeks our happiness. True happiness with God only comes through holiness, and holiness requires the purging of God. Here's the lesson we learn from Daniel 8. God's purpose is our purification. God's consuming fire purifies our souls if we will let him purge us from our impurities. God's overarching purpose in Daniel chapters 8 through 12 is to purify the nation of Israel. And in Daniel 9:24, God tells Daniel his plan for the nation of Israel. 70 weeks have been decreed for your people and your holy city to finish the transgression, to make an end of sin, to make atonement for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy place. God's purpose was the purification of the nation of Israel. And he has a similar purpose for our lives as Christians. How does God do it? Well, the first lesson of purification in Daniel 8 is that God uses the pain of persecution to purify his people, verses 15 to 19. God uses the pain of persecution to purify his people. Listen to the words of Daniel 8, verses 15 to 19. When I, Daniel, had seen the vision, I sought to understand it. And behold, standing before me was one who looked like a man. And I heard the voice of a man between the banks of Ulai, and he called out and said, Gabriel, give this man an understanding of the vision. So he came near to where I was standing, and when he came I was frightened and fell on my face. But he said to me, Son of man, understand that the vision pertains to the time of the end. Now, while he was talking with me, I sank into a deep sleep with my face to the ground. But he touched me and made me stand upright. He said, Behold, I am going to let you know what will occur at the final period of the indignation, for it pertains to the appointed time of the end. Verse 19 explains for us God's purpose in dealing with Israel so painfully. God tells Daniel through the angel Gabriel that this prophecy refers to the final period of indignation and the appointed time of the end. These two expressions obviously refer to the same period of time. But when is that time that God has appointed? The word indignation is used in the Old Testament for any period of history where God is angry with the people of Israel because of their rebellion against him. When God punishes the nation of Israel, he uses Gentile powers to conquer them, and these times of discipline are called indignation. When Assyria conquered Israel in the 700s BC, it is known as the time of God's indignation, according to Isaiah 10:5 and verse 25. When Babylon conquered Jerusalem in 586 BC, it is called the time of God's indignation, according to Lamentations 2:6 and Zechariah 1:12. In Daniel 11, we are told that the Antichrist will prosper during the tribulation period until the time of the indignation is finished. All of this tells us that God is predicting a time when Israel will be punished by foreign powers because of their rebellion against God. This punishment is at the appointed time of the end, or in the latter times that are destined by God. Verses 20 to 22, which I'll look at in just a minute, identify the fulfillment of this prophecy through the Medo-Persian and Greek empires that are past history to us today, but they were future in Daniel's day. Yet, if the prophecy is fulfilled around 165 BC, this does not fully do justice to the expression time of the end. How are we to understand this prophecy in terms of both our past and the future implications inherent in the prophecy? The ancient Hebrew way of writing was cyclical, whereas the modern Western style is linear and sequential. We tend to write in sequence. They wrote in circles. The best way to understand these and all other prophetic passages is to see them as generic prophecies, to use a term coined by Old Testament scholar Walt Kaiser. Every prophecy has one fulfillment, but many parallels or reference points down through history. These events are played out in cycles of history, so that many prophecies have multiple reference points. This keeps prophecy applicable to many generations and periods of history. I often use the analogy of mountain peaks. When we were climbing Mount Katahdin years ago with our girls, we arrived at a point where the girls thought the next peak that they could see was the top. When they climbed to the top of that peak, They could see the higher peak behind it, so they gave out an audible groan of dismay. Well, this is like prophecy. We often think that we are coming to the fulfillment only to find that we could not see the next peak behind the one we were climbing. All of that is to say that the principle here is clear. God's past purifications of Israel picture God's future purification of Israel. Daniel gives this prophecy in 551 BC. The fulfillment of this prophecy takes place when Medo-Persia conquered Babylon in 539 BC and when Greece conquered the Medo-Persian Empire in 334 BC. Finally, the little horn rose to power in 171 BC and desecrated the Temple of Jerusalem from 167 BC to 164 BC. Fulfilling the prophecy made to Daniel 387 years earlier. Yet, this prophecy pictures or illustrates a similar time at the end of the age when God will once again punish Israel for her rebellion and purify her for restoration into the eternal kingdom of God, much like smaller mountain peaks look like the higher mountain peak. Chapters 8 through 12 of Daniel are primarily about the nation of Israel and her future. And we can draw applications from these chapters, but ethnic Israel is the center point of God's program on earth. What can we learn from Israel's example? What lessons can we apply to our lives in America in the 21st century from the ways God dealt with Israel in the past and will deal with her in the future? We can learn that sometimes God must hurt us to help us. A Norfolk Southern train was rolling down the rails of Indiana at 24 miles per hour. The conductor, Robert Moore, spotted something on the track ahead. The engineer thought it was a dog on the tracks. Then Moore screamed, "That's a baby!" The baby was 19-month-old Emily Marshall, who had wandered away from her home while her mother was planting flowers in the backyard. The engineer hit the brakes. Moore bolted out the door of the engine and raced along the ledge to the front of the engine. He realized that there was no time to jump ahead of the train and grab the baby, and the train could not stop in time. So he climbed the steps at the front of the train, squatted at the bottom, and hung on. As the train drew close to Emily, she rolled off the track, but not far enough to avoid being hit. So Moore stretched out his leg in front of the slowing train and kicked Emily out of the way. Then, when the train stopped, he leaped off, picked up the little girl, and cradled her in his arms. She ended up with a cut on her head and a swollen lip, but she was otherwise safe. Sometimes, like that baby girl, God has to hurt us to help us. God disciplines those he loves. Why? Because he wants to purify us just like he seeks to purify Israel. Alexander Solzhenitsyn was a Russian dissident who wrote extensively about his experience in the Russian Gulag, the prison system. Solzhenitsyn made a strange discovery while he was suffering in a Soviet prison cell. He wrote, "It was only when I lay there on rotting prison straw that I sensed within myself the first stirrings of good. Gradually, it was disclosed to me that the line separating good and evil passes not through states, nor between classes, nor between political parties either, but right through every human heart, and through all human hearts. Bless you, prison, for having been in my life. My friends, faith cries out, bless you, my pain, for having been in my life. You see, God uses the pain of persecution to purify his people. And the second lesson of purification is God uses the power of nations to purify his people. Verses 20 to 22. The ram which you saw with the two horns represents the kings of Media and Persia. The shaggy goat represents the kingdom of Greece, and the large horn that is between his eyes is the first king. The broken horn and the four horns that arose in its place represent four kingdoms which will arise from his nation, although not with his power. God tells Daniel that Gentile nations will oppress his people for the next 30 years. Furthermore, that oppression is only a foretaste of what the nation of Israel will experience at the end of the age. First, the Persians, then the Greeks, then the Romans will oppress the Jews. Although God does not predict the Germans in the 20th century, the Germans follow in this line of Gentile powers that oppress God's chosen people. This process continues until the end of this age when God purifies and restores his people and gives them rest at last in the land of Israel. We can state the principle this way. The past sufferings of Israel picture the future sufferings of Israel. We've already dealt extensively with this part of Daniel's prophecy in the previous verses of Daniel 8. Let me just point out that this is all part of God's overall plan to restore his people to purity and holiness in his kingdom. Sometimes God allows the Adolf Hitlers of this world to exercise power because he uses them to purify his people, including the Church of Jesus Christ. This process is true for Israel, and it is true for the church. The sufferings God's people experience serve a greater purpose in God's overall plan. Remember Joseph, whose brothers sold him into slavery? God used him to rescue them from the famine years later. And Joseph told his brothers, "Do not be afraid, for am I in God's place? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring about this present result to preserve many people alive." God knows how to work good out of evil. God allowed the Romans to crucify the Son of God because he had a greater purpose in mind, the salvation of mankind. I like how John Piper puts it. God willed what he abhorred. God wills what he abhors. Imagine taking snapshots of human history from a narrow lens or a wide-angle lens. In the narrow lens of one time and place, the crucifixion was horrendous and evil. In the wide-angle lens of eternity, the crucifixion was a wonderful event, for the cross brought us salvation. This is how we must view God's sovereignty whenever we face evil in this world. The atheist philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche expressed a biblical truth when he said these words, "Men and women can endure any amount of suffering so long as they know the why to their existence." He's right. As Christians, we know the ultimate why of all that happens to us. God is purifying us for his eternal kingdom. Holiness is God's goal. Eternity is God's focus. The mystery of God's sovereignty is offensive to us because we do not understand God's ways. We think only in the near future, in the present. But eternity changes everything. The answers to our whys are only found in God's eternal plan. It is only in eternity we will understand the evil of today. Somehow, some way, to allow evil to flourish for a time and then to redeem us out of evil brings God greater glory than to refuse to allow evil in the first place. I don't really understand that principle, but it's true. St. Augustine put it this way: God judged it better to bring good out of evil than to suffer no evil at all. That leads us to the third principle of purification. God uses the pride of pagans to purify his people, verses 23 to 26. It seems counterintuitive. God uses pagans to purify saints. We don't like that concept. I certainly don't. But we can clearly see that process in Scripture. Listen to the words of Daniel. In the latter period of their rule, when the transgressors have run their course, a king will arise, insolent and skilled in intrigue. His power will be mighty, but not by his own power, and he will destroy to an extraordinary degree, and prosper, and perform his will. He will destroy mighty men and the holy people, and through his shrewdness he will cause deceit to succeed by his influence. And he will magnify himself in his heart, and he will destroy many while they are at ease. He will even oppose the prince of princes, but he will be broken without human agency. The vision of the evenings and mornings which has been told is true, but keep the vision secret, for it pertains to many days in the future. I believe that these verses were fulfilled in the life of a man named Antiochus Epiphanes, who ruled Syria and oppressed Jerusalem from 171 to 169 BC. Yet these verses and his life foreshadow or illustrate for us the role of another world leader who will rise to power at a time yet future to us today. This world leader will oppress Jerusalem and raise his fist against God, and God will defeat him as God defeated Antiochus 2,200 years ago. You see, my friends, the past Antiochus pictures the future Antiochus. The past Antiochus pictures the future Antichrist. That's the future Antiochus. Look at verse 23. In the latter period of their rule, when the transgressors have run their course, a king will arise, insolent and skilled in intrigue. The Greek Empire fractured into four kingdoms after Alexander the Great died. God had declared that in the latter days of these four kingdoms, a king would rise up from one of the kingdoms to oppress the nation of Israel. This would occur when the transgressors had run their course or finished their transgressions. The transgressors, in this passage, are Israelites, who had rebelled against God according to Daniel 8, verse 12. Israel was judged by the pagan nations because of Israel's transgressions against God. God cares about the morality of his people more than the morality of pagan nations. Why? God is purifying his people. We'd say the same thing about the church. God cares more about the morality of the church than he does about the nation. Why? Because God is purifying his church. And that is why God predicts through Daniel 70 weeks of suffering for the holy city in order to finish the transgression, according to Daniel's famous prophecy in Daniel 9:24. We know that many Jewish leaders turned their backs on God during the period of the Greek Empire and embraced the Hellenistic practices of the empire. At this time, a king would rise who would be insolent and skilled in intrigue or bold and crafty. The last word indicates that this king would be skilled in double dealing. Antiochus was an expert in political treachery. He was not the rightful heir to the Syrian throne. Instead, he bribed his way into power and became the eighth ruler of the Seleucid dynasty through deceit. The first characteristic of Antiochus was treachery. Look at verse 24. His power will be mighty, but not by his own power. And he will destroy to an extraordinary degree and prosper and perform his will. He will destroy mighty men and the holy people. So the second characteristic was power. The verse tells us that he would be powerful, but not by his own power. The implication is that his power came from an evil supernatural source. I think we can infer that he was empowered by Satan to wage war against the nation of Israel. Every evil ruler who stands against God is empowered by the evil one himself. Antiochus was brutal and cruel in his attacks on Israel. He attacked Jerusalem, tearing down major parts of the city, looting and burning it. He achieved a fair degree of military success, and righteous Jews must have thought that he was free to operate as he will. Antiochus forbade the Jews to circumcise their children, and he made possession of the scriptures a capital offense. So where was God in all this? Daniel tells us that God allowed this man to prosper as part of God's discipline for his people. Verse 25, and through his shrewdness, he will cause deceit to succeed by his influence. The third characteristic was deceit. He would destroy many people just when they felt safe and secure. Antiochus sent a tax collector to Jerusalem with many soldiers. He instructed this tax collector to speak words of peace to the city officials and so lull them into a false sense of security in the city. Then they attacked the inhabitants and slaughtered many of the men. They carried off into slavery many Jewish women and children. Verse 25 continues this amazing prediction. And he will magnify himself in his heart, and he will destroy many while they are at ease. He will even oppose the prince of princes, but he will be broken without human agency. The fourth characteristic of Antiochus was his pride. He magnified himself greatly. He even opposed the prince of princes. This would be a reference to God himself in the person of Christ, the Messiah. Any blow against Messiah's people is an attack on the Messiah. Back in verse 11, we are told that Antiochus would magnify himself to be equal with the commander of the host. Well, this would be God himself. So he exalts himself against God, just as the later little horn will do at the end of this age. Antiochus attacked Jerusalem in 167 BC. He plundered the temple of God in Jerusalem and dedicated the temple to the Greek god Zeus. He stopped the Jewish sacrifices and made it illegal to sacrifice to God, just as God had predicted to Daniel back in verses 12 and 13. Antiochus actually sacrificed a pig on the altar of the temple in order to defile the temple. And he had coins minted with the title, Antiochus Theos Epiphanes, which means Antiochus, God made manifest or revealed. God, he said, was revealed in him. He was God's revealed man. God predicts that this evil man will come to his end without any human means. This literally comes true with Antiochus. God removed him from power when God determined that the time was right to remove him from power. There are conflicting accounts of his end, but in all of the accounts, he died of a horrible disease. Josephus, the Jewish historian, agrees with the account in 2 Maccabees 9. According to the book of 2 Maccabees, Antiochus was in Ecbatana when he heard the news that the Maccabees had won a great victory over his soldiers. He was seized with severe abdominal pains, fell out of his chariot in which he was riding. He was badly injured by the fall, but shortly after that, he died of a case of worms in his intestines that left a revolting stench emanating from his body. Josephus and the books of Maccabees tell us that he actually pleaded with God in the end to save his life, but to no avail. God judged this evil man for his evil deeds. Listen to verse 26. The vision of the evenings and mornings which has been told is true, but keep the vision secret, for it pertains to many days in the future. Now look back to verse 14. God allowed this evil man to have his ways for a limited period of time. The verse says he had 2,300 mornings and evenings in which to exercise his power. That's it. If that refers to 2,300 days, and we assume it does, then he had a little over 6 years to reign. That's what Daniel predicted. Antiochus persecuted the Jews from 171 BC to 164 BC, or a little over 6 years. If we are to take the 2,300 mornings and evenings as the number of morning and evening sacrifices that Antiochus abolished, then the number of days is 1,150, or 3 years, or a little over 3 years. Antiochus sacrificed the pig on the altar in the month of Chislev in 167 BC, but the sacrifices were probably stopped shortly before that. The sacrifices were restored on the 29th of Chislev, 164 BC. This is the 14th of December. We know that Judas Maccabeus and his army of soldiers defeated the Greeks, cleansed the temple, and restored the sacrifices on this date, just over 3 years after Antiochus had abolished them. We know this because God's victory over the pagan Greeks is celebrated even today as Hanukkah. God keeps his promises to his people, just as Daniel predicted. Hanukkah celebrates the fact that God keeps his promises to the Jewish people. They can rejoice in God. This remarkable prophecy was fulfilled down to the very details of God's prediction to Daniel 387 years before. God keeps his promises to Israel, and God keeps his promises to us. Suffering is hard. Nobody wants to suffer. Evil is all around us. But God is with us. And God will restore us as he will restore Israel. Meanwhile, the sufferings of this life are designed to make us holy. God is in the business of purifying his people for his eternal kingdom. God is working for eternity, not today. I think of the prairie fire when I think of this chapter. The nation of Israel needed to learn the lesson so powerfully communicated in the song Refiner's Fire. It's the same lesson that God is trying to teach us as believers, as Christians today. I think how much our nation needs God's purifying work, but it starts with us, my friends, because God always starts with the church. It starts with believers. He is working to purify us. It starts with us. Listen to the lyrics of Refiner's Fire and apply them to us as Christians in the church. Purify my heart. Let me be as gold and precious silver. Purify my heart. Let me be as gold, pure gold. Refiner's fire. My heart's one desire is to be holy, set apart for you, Lord. I choose to be holy, set apart for you, my master, ready to do your will. My friends, God's purpose is our purification. Charles Spurgeon wrote, "Our lusts are cords that bind us. Fiery trials are sent to burn and consume them, the lusts. Who fears the flame which will bring him liberty from intolerable bonds?" The flame, the fire, is liberating. God calls us to personal purity. Are you willing to follow the Lord even through the purifying fire that will make you holy?